and watching too much daytime TV. Duncan was making a big deal of putting his coat on, desperate to glean anything he could from what might be his last couple of minutes with Tucker. "You don't have to leave," Tucker said wearily. Duncan looked at him disbelievingly, a 16-year-old who'd just been told that the prettiest girl in the class wasn't going to finish with him just yet.
"Really?"
"Really. What you said before, it meant a lot. Thank you, sincerely." And now, the prettiest girl in class was taking off her panties and... Actually, this whole analogy was too weird. Weird and disturbingly self-serving, if anyone cared to examine it properly. "If you'd like to talk to me about my work, I'd be happy to do so. I can see you're serious about it."
What was the big deal?
Why had he spent half his life trying to hide from people like Duncan? How many of them were there? A handful, scattered all over the globe? Fuck the internet for collecting them all in one place and making them look threatening. And fuck the internet for putting him right at the center of his own little paranoid universe. "I really am sorry about taking a pee in Julie Beatty's toilet," said Duncan. "I'm not sure I care as much as I pretended. Off the record, among certain people, Julie Beatty has enjoyed a long and unsullied reputation as a fiery muse. In retrospect, she was kind of a pretty airhead. If someone pees in her toilet every now and again, it's a fair price to pay." The two biggest parts of a man's life were his family and his work, and Tucker had spent a long time feeling wretched about both of them. There was nothing much he could do about big chunks of his family now. Things would never be right with Grace, and he could see that his relationship with Lizzie would always wobble between something they could both tolerate and something that would hurt his ears. He wasn't so interested in the older boys. That left Jackson, which gave him a 20% success rate as a father. There was no examination worth taking where you could pass with a mark like that. It had never occurred to him that his work was redeemable or that he was redeemable through his work. But as he listened that afternoon to an articulate, nerdy man tell him over and over again why he was a genius, he could feel himself hoping that it might actually be true.
Chapter 15. Counselor Terry Jackson had come to the museum for a private view and seemed pleased with what he'd seen. Indeed, he was so pleased that he now had ambitions for the launch.
"We should try and get a celebrity to come along and open it."
"Do you know any celebrities?" said Annie.
"No. You?"
"No."
"Oh, well. Who would you invite if you could?"
"I'm not very good at celebrities. I don't watch enough TV."
"Anyone in world history. Fantasy guest."
She said. "And what function would this person be serving? I mean, would we be inviting him or her to say a few words?"
"I would have thought so," said Terry. "Something to get the local press interested, maybe even the nationals."
"I'd have thought that if a dead person from world history opened an exhibition at the Goulner Seaside Museum, we'd be fighting the media off."
"So who would you have?"
"Jane Austen," said Annie. "Or Emily Bronte, I suppose, seeing as we're not that far from Bronte country."
"You think the national press would come up here for Emily Bronte? I know they would for Jane Austen, Bollywood and all that."
Annie had no idea what this meant, and as a consequence chose to ignore it. "Even for Emily Bronte?"
"Well," said Terry, he was clearly dubious, "if you say so. Anyway, let's keep it within the realms of the possible."
"So you're asking me to name a famous person who might actually come to the Goulner Seaside Museum to open an exhibition? Because that's different."
"No, it isn't. Aim as high as you like."
"Nelson Mandela."
"Lower."
"Simon Cowell." Terry thought for a moment.
"Lower."
"The mayor."
"The mayor's got another do on. If you'd sorted this out quicker, we could have asked her first."
"I've got an American singer-songwriter from the 80s staying with me at the moment. Would he be any good?" She hadn't planned to mention him, but Terry Jackson's unfair attack on her organizational skills had stung. And in any case, She couldn't quite believe that he'd chosen to stay. Tucker and Jackson had been with her for 3 nights already and showed no desire to leave.
"Depends who he is," said Terry.
"Tucker Crow."
"Tuckeroo?"
"Tucker Crow."
"No. No good whatsoever. Nobody's heard of him."
"Well, which American singer-songwriter from the 80s would have done the trick?" He was beginning to annoy her now. Where had this sudden need for celebrity come from? It was always the way with counsellors. At the beginning of a project, it was all about the needs of the town. By the end, it was all about the Ghoulness Echo.
"I thought you were going to say Billy Joel or someone. Is he a singer-songwriter? He'd have got us out of a hole. Anyway, thanks, but no thanks, Tucker Crow."
He made air quotes around the name and he chuckled, apparently at the depths of Tucker's obscurity.
"I've an idea," said Terry.
"Go on."
"Three words."
"Right.
Have a guess."
"Three words?"
"Three words."
"John Logie Baird. Harriet Beecher Stowe."
"No, neither of them. Oh, and I should probably say that one of the words is and."
"And?"
"Like Simon and Garfunkel?" "Yes, but not them. I think you should give up."
"I give up."
"Gavin Barnsley!"
Annie burst out laughing. Terry Jackson looked hurt.
"I'm sorry," said Annie. "I wasn't being... That wasn't the direction I was looking in."
"What do you think? They're local legends, and a lot of people around here recognize them."
"I like it," said Annie decisively.
"Really?"
"Really." Terry Jackson smiled.
"Bit of a brainwave, really. Even if I do say so myself."
"There'd probably be no national press interest," said Annie.
"That's all right. That was always going to be a long shot."
Annie had once heard someone say that in the future, everyone would be famous to 15 people. In Ghoulness, where Tucker Crow slept in her bedroom and Gav and Barnsley were invited to open exhibitions, the future had arrived. On Wednesday, the day of the launch party, Tucker and Jackson were still with her. Their departure was postponed one day at a time. Annie didn't want to press them on their plans because she couldn't bear the thought of them leaving. Every morning she was fearful that they would come into the kitchen for breakfast with their bags packed. But instead, they announced plans to fish, or walk, or take a bus along the coast. She had no idea whether Jackson was supposed to be at school, but again, she didn't want to ask, in case Tucker suddenly slapped his forehead and dragged his son off to the station. She couldn't have explained to anybody what she was hoping for, or at least she wouldn't have wanted to, because the explanation would have sounded pathetic, even to her. She was hoping, she supposed, that they would stay forever, in any formation that they chose. If Tucker didn't want to share a bed with her, well, fine. Although she firmly intended to sleep with someone at some stage, and if he didn't like it, he could shove it. These scenarios had been imagined quite fully, hence the confrontational tone. She'd scripted this particular conversation on Sunday night when she was trying to get to sleep, and she had found herself getting irritated by Tucker's predicted indifference. She would, of course, have to replace Kat, at least for most of the year. She fully anticipated trips back to the US during the longer holidays, although Jackson would be attending school in Ghoulness, maybe at Rose Hill, which had an excellent reputation and an impressive website, which she happened to have stumbled across the previous evening. How hard would that be for Jackson? He hadn't talked about his mother that much, which gave her hope. His primary relationship was clearly with Tucker, and she was pretty sure that if Tucker was unambiguous about what he wanted, his boy would fall into line. She would offer to email Kat weekly or daily or whatever she wanted, and she could attach pictures, and they could talk on the phone, and she could download the thing that allowed you to see someone in Australia on the computer, and Kat could stay whenever she wanted. If everyone was determined to make it work, then it would. After all, what was the alternative? That they just went home and resumed their lives as if nothing had happened? The trouble was that nothing had happened, of course. If Tucker and Jackson were able to hear the inside of her head, they'd have backed slowly out of the house, with Tucker brandishing whatever weapon he could lay his hands on in order to protect his son. Did her mother entertain similar fantasies when Christmas was coming to an end, and she knew that she was going to be left with and by herself for another 11¾ months? Probably. Everything had come too soon. That was the problem. Annie would have been happy enough looking forward to Tucker's emails, with the remote and tantalizing possibility of an actual meeting to be dreamed about, only slowly, over months, and then years. Because of the various medical misfortunes, she'd ended up scoffing the whole lot within weeks, and now she was left with an empty chocolate box and a vague feeling of nausea. She had to concede, reluctantly, that there was another interpretation of recent events. The problem wasn't the empty box, but the metaphor. The short visit of a middle-aged man and his young son shouldn't be a gourmet pastry. It should be a store-bought egg salad sandwich, a distracted bowl of cereal, an apple snatched from a fruit bowl when you didn't have time to eat. She had somehow constructed a life so empty that she was in the middle of the defining narrative incident of the last 10 years, and what did it consist of, really? If Tucker and Jackson did, after all, decide that their lives should be lived elsewhere, and so far, anyway, they had given very little indication to the contrary, she had to make sure that if they did ever come back, their stay would be an irritation, something she could have done without, something she wouldn't even remember a couple of weeks after they'd gone. That was how it was supposed to be with house guests, wasn't it? When she came downstairs, she was wearing a skirt and some makeup. And Tucker looked at her. "Oh, shoot," he said. It wasn't what she might have hoped for, but at least it was a reaction. He'd noticed, anyway. "What?" "I'm going to have to go like this. I guess I might have a clean T-shirt, but I think it might have the name of a lap dancing club on it. It's not like I'm a customer or anything. It was a thoughtful present from somebody. What about you, Jack? Got anything clean left?"
"I put a couple of things in the wash," said Annie. "There's a new something man T-shirt on your bed."
A lot of women had to say a version of that sentence every single day of the week, probably, without feeling particularly emotional about it. Or rather, the emotion they were most likely to feel was a very deep self-pity, rather than an ache of love and loss and longing. That seemed like an ambition of sorts. To get to a stage where she wanted to hang herself because putting a T-shirt on a child's bed seemed indicative of the slow and painful death of the spirit. At the moment, she wanted to hang herself because it seemed like the first tiny glimmers of a rebirth.
"Spider, is Spider-Man okay for your party?"
"I'm the only one who has to go dressed up," she said. "You're the exotic special guests."
"Only because we'll be wearing T-shirts," said Tucker.
"And you come from the U.S. When we first started thinking about a Ghoulness in 1964 exhibition, we really weren't banking on American visitors."
"The exchange rate was bad back then," said Tucker. "You watch, there'll be hordes of us."
Annie laughed with inappropriate volume and vigor, and at preposterous length, and Tucker stared at her.
"You nervous?"
"No."
"Oh, okay."
"I was just thinking about you leaving. I don't want you to. And that made me laugh too loudly at your joke, for some reason. Maybe just in case it was the last joke you made in this house." She regretted the explanation immediately. But that was because she always regretted everything. And then, after the regret had flared and burned out, she didn't care. He should know, she thought. She wanted him to know. She felt something for somebody, and she'd told him.
"Okay. Who said we're leaving, anyway? We like it here, don't we, Jacko?"
"Yeah, a bit. But I wouldn't want to live here or anything."
"I could live here," said Tucker. "I could live here in a heartbeat."
"Really?" said Annie.
"Sure. I like the sea. I like the lack of pretension."
"Oh, it's not pretentious."
"What does that word even mean?" said Jackson.
"It means the town doesn't pretend to be something it isn't."
"And some towns do that? What do they pretend to be?"
"Paris, giraffes, whatever.
I like to go somewhere that pretends to be somewhere else. That sounds fun.
He was right. It sounded fun. Who wanted to be in a place that prided itself on its lack of ambition, its pig-headed delight in its own plainness?
Anyway, said Jackson, I have to see Mom and my friends and...
And even then, Annie hoped for some clinching argument from Tucker, as if she were watching a courtroom drama and Jackson was the slow-witted and obstructive juror. But he just put his arm on his son's shoulder and told him not to worry. And Annie gave another inappropriate laugh just to show that nothing was serious and everything was funny and it didn't matter that Christmas was nearly over. She was nervous now.
Tucker was worried for Annie when they walked into the cold and ominously empty museum, but then he remembered that she was the host and she had to be there first, and they didn't have to wait very long before people started turning up. Late wasn't a fashion option in Ghoulinus, apparently. Before long, the room was full of town councillors and friends of the museum and proud owners of shark pieces, all of whom seemed to have taken the view that the later you turned up, the narrower the choice of sandwiches and potato chips. Once upon a time, Tucker hated going to parties because he couldn't introduce himself without people making some kind of a fuss when he told them his name. It turned out to be the same at this party, except the people who made the fuss were people who'd apparently never heard of him.
Tucker Crowe,
said Terry Jackson, the counselor who owned half the exhibition.
The Tucker Crowe.
Terry Jackson was probably in his 60s, and he had a weird gray hairdo. And Tucker was surprised that his name had any currency in weird gray hairdo circles. But then Terry gave Annie a big wink, and Annie rolled her eyes and looked embarrassed, and Tucker understood that something else was going on.
Annie wanted you to be the special guest tonight, but then I pointed out that nobody knew who the bloody hell you were. What was your big hit then? Just kidding.
He patted Tucker on the back mirthfully.
But you really are from America.
I really am.
Well then,
said Terry consolingly,
we don't get many American visitors to Ghoulness. You might be the first one ever. That's special enough for us. Doesn't matter about the rest of it.
He really is famous, said Annie. I mean, if you know who he is.
Well, we're all famous in our own living rooms, aren't we? What are you drinking there, Tucker? I'm going to get myself another one.
Just a water, thanks.
I don't think so, said Terry. I'm not getting Ghoulness's only American visitor a glass of bloody water. Red or white?
I'm in recovery, said Tucker.
All the more reason to have a drink, then. Always helps me when I'm under the weather.
He's not under the weather, said Annie. He's a recovering alcoholic.
Oh, you just be normal here, when in Rome and all that.
I'm fine, thanks.
Oh, well, suit yourself. Here they are, the real stars of the evening.
They had been joined by two men in their 40s, obviously uncomfortable in jackets and ties.
Let me introduce you to two Ghoulness legends. Gav, Barnsey, this is Tucker Crowe from America, and this is Jackson.
Hello, said Jackson, and they shook his hand with exaggerated formality.
I've heard that name before,
one of the men said. There's a singer named Jackson Brown, said Jackson. Also, there's a place called Jackson. I've never been there, which is kind of weird if you think about it.
No, not your name, Sonny Jim. He's... Tucker, what's it?
I doubt it, said Tucker.
No, you're right, Barnsey, said the other one. It's come up recently.
Did you get here okay? Said Annie.
You were going on about him,
said the man who had to be Gav, triumphantly.
That night we met you, in the pub.
Was I? Said Annie.
Oh, she's always going on about him, said Terry Jackson. In her head, he's famous. You're country and western, is that right?
I never said that, said Annie. I said I'd been listening to you recently because of Naked, I suppose.
No, you said he was your favorite singer,
said Barnsey.
But is he the person you said you were seeing in America?
No, said Annie. That was someone else.
Bloody hell, said Barnsey. You know more Americans than an American.
I'm sorry, said Annie when they'd gone. We seem to keep bumping into people who think we're together. You just told them you were seeing some other American.
Well, I'm not.
I guessed. Tucker had known for some time that Annie had some sort of crush on him, and he was too old to feel anything other than a childish sense of delight. She was an attractive woman. Good company, kind, younger than him. 10 or 15 years or so ago, he would have felt obliged to enumerate all the individual items on his baggage carousel and point out that their relationship was doomed, that he always made a mess of everything, that they lived on separate continents, and so on. But he was almost certain that she'd been paying enough attention to what he'd been saying, so caveat emptor. But then what? He didn't even know if he was capable of having sex, or whether having sex would kill him if the capability was there, and if sex was going to kill him, then would he be happy to die here, in this town, in Annie's bed? Jackson wouldn't be happy, that was for sure. But was Tucker prepared not to have sex until Jackson was capable of looking after himself? He was 6 now, what, 12 years? In 12 years, Tucker would be almost 70, and that would raise a whole lot of other questions. For example, who'd want to have sex with him when he was 70? If he was even capable of having sex. The worst thing about his little medical event was the questions, which had started to come in an apparently unstoppable flood. Not all of them were about whether anybody would want to have sex with him when he was almost 70. There had been a few really tricky ones related to the empty decades since Juliet and the decades, he liked to think of a plural, to come. There weren't going to be any answers to these tricky questions either, which made them seem tauntingly rhetorical. If he were a character in a movie, a few days in a strange town with a kind woman would renew his faith in something or other, and he'd go straight home and make a great album. But that wasn't going to happen. The tank was as empty as it had always been. And then, just as Tucker was about to give in to his gloom, Terry Jackson pressed a button on a boombox, and the room filled with the sound of a soul singer Tucker recognized. Major Lance, Dobie Gray, and Gavin Barnsley started doing backflips and head spins on the museum carpet.
I bet you could do that, Dad, couldn't you?
Said Jackson.
Sure,
said Tucker.
Annie was stuck with the most faithful friend the museum had ever had. But out of the corner of her eye, she saw an elderly lady having her picture taken beside the photograph of the 4 workmates on their day off. Annie made her excuses and went over to introduce herself.
Hello, Annie, the museum director, said the elderly lady. I'm Kathleen, Kath. Do you know any of these people?
That's me, said Kath. I knew my teeth were bad, but I didn't know they were that bad. No wonder I lost them.
Annie looked at the photo, then back at the old woman. As far as Annie could tell, she was 75 now, and she'd been 60 in 1964.
You've hardly aged a bit, Annie said. Really?
I know what you're saying. I was old then, and I'm old now.
Not a bit of it, said Annie. Do you keep in touch with the others?
That's my sister. She passed on. The lads, they'd come up for the day from Nottingham, I think. I never saw them again.
You looked like you were having fun.
I suppose so. I wish we'd had a bit more, though, if you know what I mean.
Annie made an appropriately scandalized face.
He wanted to. His hands were everywhere. I fought him off.
Well, said Annie, you can never go wrong not doing something. It's only when you do things that you get into trouble.
I suppose so, said Kath.
But now what?
What do you mean?
I mean, I'm 77 and I never got into any trouble. So now what?
Have you got a medal for me? You're a museum director. Write to the Queen and tell her. Otherwise it was all a bloody waste of time, wasn't it?
No, said Annie, don't say that.
What should I say instead, then?
Annie smiled blankly. Would you excuse me for a moment? She said. She went to find Roz, who seemed to be giving an impromptu lecture on the typography of Terry Jackson's Rolling Stones poster, and told her to take Jackson away from his father and stuff him full of twiglets.
Then Annie pulled Tucker into the corner where they had displayed Terry Jackson's old bus tickets, which weren't attracting as much traffic as they'd hoped.
You okay? Said Tucker. Seems to be going pretty well.
Tucker, I was wondering whether... if you'd be interested...
in...
Oh, sorry, me.
I'm already interested in you. The conditional is unnecessary.
Thank you. But I suppose I mean sexually. The blush, which she had more or less kept in check over the last few days, was returning with a pent-up force. The blood had clearly been pooling, frustrated, somewhere in the region of her ears. She really needed her face to do something different when she asked a man to sleep with her. It seemed to her that the very act of asking made the request irritatingly unlikely.
What about the party?
I meant later.
I was kidding.
Oh, I see. Anyway, I told myself I'd broach the subject. I've done it now. Thank you for listening.
And she turned to go. Pleasure. And, of course, I'm interested, by the way, if the answer to your question isn't beside the point.
Oh, no, it isn't. Good.
I would have jumped on you by now if it hadn't been for my little scare the other day. And it still worries me.
I did actually look that... the side of things up on the internet.
Tucker laughed. This is what constitutes foreplay when you get older. A woman who's prepared to look your medical condition up before she sleeps with you. I like it. It's kind of sexy. What did the internet have to say?
Annie could see Roz leading Jackson toward them. You don't get breathless going upstairs?
Nope.
Well, you should be okay then, as long as... as I... well, do the work.
She felt the colour of an eggplant now, a kind of purpley black. Maybe he'd like that.
That's the way I've always done it. We'll be fine.
Right. Well, good then. I'll see you later.
And she went to give her little welcome speech to the great and the good of Gulenus. Later, home and drunk, she felt a kind of pre-coital tristesse.
Most of her tristesses were pre-coital, she thought gloomily. How could they not be, seeing as most of life was pre-coital?
This one was sharper than most, possibly because the coitus was a more real prospect than most. It began with an attack of nerves, a sudden lack of self-confidence. She'd seen pictures of Julie Beatty, and Julie Beatty had been breathtakingly beautiful. True, she'd been 25 or so when Tucker was with her, but Annie hadn't looked anything like that when she was 25. Natalie was still beautiful, and she was older than Annie. They all must have been, she realized. The ones she knew about, and the scores, hundreds, she didn't. And then she tried to console herself with the knowledge that Tucker must have lowered the bar by now. And of course, that was no consolation at all. She didn't want to be the dying embers of his sex life, and she certainly didn't want to be a low bar. While Tucker was putting Jackson to bed, she made tea and looked for something else to drink. When he came downstairs, she was pouring some very old banana liqueur into a tumbler and trying not to cry. She really hadn't thought the museum thing through when she first took the job. She hadn't worked out that it would make absolutely everything, even a one-night stand, feel as though it were already over. Behind a glass, a poignant relic of an earlier, happier time.
Listen, said Tucker. I've been thinking, and Annie was convinced that he had come to the same conclusion himself, and he was about to tell her that, yes, though his bar was no longer at Olympic height, it hadn't dropped that far just yet, and he'd come back to her in a decade or so. I should look at this stuff myself.
Which stuff?
The stuff on the internet that told you whether sex will kill me.
Oh, of course, no problem.
It's just, if I did drop dead, you'd probably feel bad.
Almost certainly.
You feel responsible, and I'd rather it was me that had the post-death guilt.
Why would you feel guilt?
Ah,
You're not a parent, are you? Guilt is pretty much all I feel.
Annie found the website she'd been looking at and showed him the section titled Recovery.
Can I trust this one? Said Tucker.
It's the National Health Service. They usually want to keep you out of the hospital. The government can't afford you, and anyway, the hospitals kill you.
Okay. Hey, there's a whole sex section. Having sex will not put you at further risk of another heart attack. We're good to go.
It also says that most people will feel comfortable about resuming sexual activity about 4 weeks after a heart attack.
I'm not most people. I feel comfortable now.
And then there's that bit.
She pointed at the screen, and Tucker read from it. A 30% chance of erectile dysfunction. That's good.
Why?
Because if there's nothing going on, you needn't blame yourself. Even though it would probably be your fault.
There won't be any erectile dysfunction, said Annie, mock confidently. She was blushing, of course, but they were looking at a screen in the dark of the office, and Tucker didn't notice. So for a moment she wanted to undercut the moment out loud, clap a hand over her mouth or make a joke at her own expense. But she resisted the urge and, well, there was an atmosphere, she thought. She wasn't sure she'd ever created an atmosphere before, and she would never have thought it could be achieved by talking to a man with health problems about erectile dysfunction. It was just as well, really. For the best part of 40 years, she had genuinely believed that not doing things would somehow prevent regret, when, of course, the exact opposite was true. Her youth was over, but there might be some life left in life yet. They kissed for the first time then, while the NHS website glared at them. They kissed for so long that the computer went to sleep. Annie wasn't blushing anymore, but she was feeling embarrassingly emotional, and she was worried that she'd start to cry, and he'd think she'd had too much invested in him and he'd change his mind about the sex. If he asked her what the problem was, she'd tell him she always got weepy after exhibition openings. They went upstairs, took their clothes off with their backs to each other, got into her cold bed, and started to touch.
You were right, said Tucker.
So far, anyway, said Annie. But there was that bit about maintenance.
And I'll tell you, said Tucker, you're not making maintenance much easier.
I'm sorry.
I didn't come prepared, for understandable reasons. You don't keep anything lying around, do you?
Oh, said Annie, yes, of course. But I don't have any condoms. You'll have to excuse me for a moment. She'd already thought about this moment. She'd been thinking about it since her conversation with Kath. She went to the bathroom, stayed in there for a couple of minutes, and then went back to make love to him. She didn't kill him, even though it felt like parts of her had been asleep for as long as Tucker's career. The following day, Jackson talked to his mother on the phone and became upset, and Tucker booked their flights home. On the last night, Tucker and Annie shared a bed, but they didn't have sex again.
I'll come back, said Tucker. I like it here.
Nobody comes back. Annie didn't know whether she meant the town or the bed, but either way there was some bitterness in there, and she didn't want that.
Or you could come over.
I've used up a lot of my holidays.
There are other jobs.
I'm not taking lectures on alternative careers from you.
Okay. So, I'm never coming back here, you're never going over there. It's difficult to find a place where we can at least pretend that there's some sort of future.
Is that what you normally do after a one-night stand? Said Annie. Pretend there's a future. She couldn't seem to change the tone in her voice, no matter what she did. She didn't want to scoff and taunt. She wanted to find a way to hope. But she only seemed to be able to speak one language. Typical bloody British, she thought.
I'm just going to ignore you, said Tucker. She put her arms around him.
I'll miss you.
and Jackson. There. It wasn't much, and it was entirely unrepresentative of the grief and panic that were already probing for promising-looking ways of escape. But she hoped at least he heard uncomplicated affection.
You'll email, right? A lot?
Oh, I've got nothing to say.
I'll tell you when I'm bored.
Oh, God, she said. Now I'll be scared to write anything.
Jesus Christ, said Tucker, you don't make it easy.
No, said Annie, that's because it isn't. That's why mostly it goes wrong. That's why you've been divorced 1,000 times, because it isn't easy. She was trying to say something else. She was trying to say that the inability to articulate what one feels in any satisfactory way is one of our enduring tragedies. It wouldn't have been much, and it wouldn't have been useful, but it would have been something that reflected the gravity and the sadness inside her. Instead, she had snapped at him for being a loser. It was as if she were trying to find a handhold on the boulder of her feelings and had merely ended up with grit under her nails. Tucker sat up in bed and looked at her.
You should make up with Duncan, he said. He'd take you back, especially now. You've got about 9 years' worth of material for him.
Why? What good would that do me?
None at all, said Tucker. That would be the point.
She tried one last time. I'm sorry. I don't know what to say. I know that love is supposed to be transformative. Now that she'd used the word, she felt her tongue loosen. And that's how I'm trying to look at it. There. Bang. I've been transformed, and however it happened, it doesn't matter. You can go or stay, and it will still have happened. So I've been trying to look at you as a metaphor or something, but it doesn't work. The terribly inconvenient fact is that without you around, everything slides back to how it was before. It can't do otherwise. And I have to say, books haven't helped much with all this. Because whenever you read anything about love, whenever anyone tries to define it, there's always a state or an abstract noun. And I try to think of it like that. But actually, love is, well, it's just you. And when you go, it's gone. Nothing abstract about it.
Dad.
Annie was confused, but Tucker seemed to know who it was immediately. Jackson was standing by the bed, damp and malodorous.
What's up, son?
I just threw up in my bed.
Okay.
I don't think I like Twiglets anymore.
You've maybe been hitting them a little hard. We'll get you cleaned up. Do you have any spare sheets, Annie?
As they washed him and changed the bedding, Annie was trying not to feel unlucky, doomed, born under a bad sign. Feeling unlucky, she had noticed, was her default mood, and yet she could see that there were alternative interpretations of her current predicament. For example, if you choose to fall in love with an American with a young son and a home in America, who comes to stay for a couple of days, how much ill fortune is involved in his leaving you? Or could someone brighter have seen that coming? Or here's another way of looking at it. You write a review on an obscure website of an album by an artist who has chosen to remain a recluse for over 20 years. Said artist reads the review, gets in touch, comes to stay. He's very attractive and seems to be attracted to you, and you sleep with him. Is there any bad luck in that? Or could someone with a sunnier disposition come to the conclusion that the last few weeks contained something like 17 separate miracles?
Yes.
Well, she didn't have a sunny disposition, so tough. She was going to stick with the notion that she was the unluckiest woman alive. How did that fit in with the previous night, when she had pretended to put in a contraceptive device in an attempt to secretly get pregnant? How lucky would she have to be at her age, at his age, in his state of health? But maybe there was no contradiction. She could already feel the disappointment that would arrive along with her period. And maybe that was the point. Final, incontrovertible proof that there was no point in trying anything that might make her happier, because she'd fail regardless.
Can I get into your bed? Said Jackson.
Sure, said Tucker.
Can it be just you?
Sure. Tucker looked at Annie and shrugged. Thanks, he said. Over the next few weeks, that one word was subjected to more analysis than it could probably stand.
What should I tell Mom about the trip? Said Jackson when they were waiting for the plane to take off. Tell her anything you want. She knows you got sick, right? I think so. And she knows you didn't die? Yep. Cool. And how do you spell ghoulinous? Tucker told him. It's funny, said Jackson. It seems like I haven't seen Mom forever, but when I think about what we did, it wasn't that exciting, was it? I'm sorry. That's okay. Maybe if I watched a lot of SpongeBob on the way home, it would seem more exciting. Tucker didn't know whether he'd been listening to an elaborate ruse intended to obtain parental indulgence, or a simply expressed but complicated idea about the relationship between time and narrative. Jackson had put his finger on something, though. Not enough had happened, somehow. In the space of a few days, he'd had a heart attack, spoken to all of his children and two of his ex-wives, gone to a new town and slept with a new woman, spent some time with a man who had made him think differently about his work, and none of it had changed a thing. He had neither learned nor grown. He must have missed something. In the old days, he maybe could have squeezed a few songs out of this trip. There had to be a good lyric about a far-death experience, say, and Annie. He could have turned her into a pretty and redemptive girl from the North Country who had helped him to feel and heal. Maybe steal and kneel if he pushed it. She'd certainly cooked him a meal. And maybe without her he'd congeal. But if he couldn't write, what was he left with? The truth about autobiographical songs, he realized, was that you had to make the present become the past somehow. You had to take a feeling, or a friend, or a woman, and turn whatever it was into something that was over, so that you could be definitive about it. You had to put it in a glass case and look at it and think about it until it gave up its meaning. And he'd managed to do that with just about everybody he'd ever met or married or fathered. The truth about life was that nothing ever ended until you died, and even then you just left a whole bunch of unresolved narratives behind you. He'd somehow managed to retain the mental habits of a songwriter long after he'd stopped writing songs, and perhaps it was time to give them up.
Well, said Malcolm. And then there was nothing, and it was all Annie could do not to laugh.
She had spoken quickly and unhaltingly, and without swearing. She had remembered to refer to fake Tucker, rather than its contraction, for 15 minutes, and however much silence he was going to inflict on them now, she wasn't going to break it. It was his turn.
And can you still buy his CDs?
I just explained, Malcolm, this last one has only been out for a few weeks. That's how we met, sort of.
Oh, yes, sorry. Should I buy it?
No, I just explained that too, Malcolm. It's not his best one. Anyway, I'm not sure that you listening to Tucker's music would help us much.
We'll see. You'd be surprised.
This sort of situation has come up before, has it?
Malcolm looked hurt, and Annie felt sorry for him.
She didn't need to be unkind. She was feeling rather fond of him, actually. Her 15 minute splurge had justified her entire painful relationship with him. For months she'd been coming in here and telling him about Duncan's failure to buy milk when he'd been explicitly asked to do so, and they'd poked about in the ashes of her inner life in an effort to find some tiny spark of feeling. This morning, she told him about recluses and heart attacks and failed marriages and one-night stands and duplicitous attempts to get pregnant, and she thought he might explode with the effort of trying to act as if he'd been expecting a story like this all along.
Can I ask a couple of other questions, just to make sure I've got things straight?
Of course.
What did this man think you were doing in the bathroom?
Inserting a contraceptive device.
Malcolm made a note of some kind. From Annie's position, it looked like inserting cont device, and underlined it emphatically.
I see. And when did his last relationship end?
A few weeks ago.
And this woman is the mother of his youngest child?
Yes.
What's her name, actually?
Do you really need to know that?
Saying her name makes you feel uncomfortable, perhaps?
Not really. Kat.
Is that short for something?
Malcolm! I'm sorry. You're right.
There was quite a lot in there. I'm struggling to know where to start. Where do you want to start? How are you feeling?
Bereft, mostly. A bit exhilarated. How are you feeling? She knew she wasn't supposed to ask that, but she was aware that Malcolm had been through a lot in the previous 20 minutes.
Concerned.
Really?
It's not my position to judge, as you know. Actually, scrap that last remark, strike it from the record, and the concern bit.
Why?
Because I want to ask you a question, and I don't want you to think it's judgmental.
I have wiped my memory clean.
I'm just concerned about the part you might have played in ending this man's relationship, and also you bringing a child into the world with no father.
I thought we'd scrapped concerned.
Oh, yes. Anyway, how do you feel about that?
Malcolm, this is hopeless.
What have I said now?
I'm really not worried about the morality of it all.
I can see that.
So can't we talk about what I am worried about?
If we must. What are you worried about?
I want to throw everything in and move to America. Tomorrow. Sell the house and go.
Has he asked you?
No.
Well then, I think we're better off talking about how to make the best of a bad job here.
The best of a bad job?
I know you think I'm a square, or whatever you call it, but I don't see how we can call it a good job. You're unhappy, and you might be an unwed mother, and... Anyway, now you're thinking about Cloud Cuckoo Land.
Which is where, exactly?
America. I mean, it's not Cloud Cuckoo Land for Americans, but it is for you.
Why? Because you live here.
And that's it.
So there isn't really any possibility of change, then, is there?
Of course there is. That's why you're here.
But not much.
Not with the way house prices have gone recently, anyway. I don't know what you paid for yours, but you won't get it back in the current climate. Even rentals aren't very good. I've got a friend who's been trying to rent a house for next summer. Never had any trouble before, until now.
Annie had always heard the town speaking through Malcolm, ever since her first session. But now, she heard the voice of the country she had grown up in. She heard teachers and parents and teaching colleagues and friends. This was how England spoke, and she couldn't listen to her anymore. She stood up, walked over to Malcolm, kissed him on the top of his head. "Thank you," she said. "I'm all better now." And she left.
Topic: so where was I? Duncan, member. Posts: 1019. Gentlemen, so, I have it. I've had it for a couple of days, in fact. But after the debacle of naked mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa, I have allowed it to stew for a couple of days before committing myself. But there's no putting it off. To quote another critic, writing in another time and another place, but about a similar artistic disaster, "What is this shit? We have a song about the pleasures of reading in the afternoon sunshine. We have a song about homegrown green beans. We have a cover of the Don Williams classic, You're My Best Friend. We have a major tragedy." Ray, so where was I? Better than Bob, member. Posts, 789. Thank God. I thought I was going crazy. I got home from work, downloaded the album, transferred it onto my iPod, shut myself away for the night in my study, told the boss that she couldn't come in before 10 p.m. I was out by 8:45, couldn't take it anymore. Ran screaming to the pub. Spent most of the night trying to think of a more disappointing comeback. Drew a blank. There's nothing I would willingly play for a second time. Oh, Tucker, where art thou? Racer, where was I? Juliet Lover, member. Posts 881. This album should be called Happiness is Poison. Who gives a toss if Tucker Crow has found inner peace? Talk about be careful what you wish for. I have thought about a new Tucker Crow album just about every day for 20 years. And now I wish he stayed a recluse. I heard it got turned down by every major label in America. Do you think he cares that he's let himself and everyone else down? It doesn't sound like it. Won't get fooled again. R.I.P. Tucker Crow. Racer, where was I? Mr. Mozza 7, newbie. Posts 2. I told you he was overrated. Now go and listen to everything Morrissey has ever sung, you muppets. Racer, where was I? Uptown Girl, junior member. Posts 1. Hi, everyone. First time caller, or whatever you are on the internet. My husband and I recently came across the album So Where Was I by Tucker Crow, and we both absolutely love it. We found another one called Juliet, but it's a bit gloomy for our liking. Can you recommend any others of his we might enjoy? Ray, So Where Was I? Better Than Bob, member. Posts 790. Dear God.
We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Juliet Naked by Nick Hornby. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced and directed by Kevin Thompson. Juliet Naked is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc. Copyright 2009. All rights reserved. The book Juliet Naked is available wherever Riverhead books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.